and yet under the law as articulated in State versus Garcia, we are not able to distinguish between those distinctly different kinds of criminal conduct.
Question. I haven't ever approached it this way before, Bill, but being facetious, could you not go to the statute and define the crime more adequately so that the burglary would be rather than simply with the intent to commit a crime therein, but would be with the intent to, and then have subsections commit rape, commit theft, commit, and identify them that way so that you charge accordingly?
I think the answer is you could do that, and it would be a much more difficult undertaking than the admittedly difficult undertaking of trying to define how many crimes you're going to permit a prosecutor and the jury to carve out of an offense. I think we have in 2267 at least a framework, a starting point for the consideration of the various policy issues which you're familiar with from the task force's work. Judge Hargreaves points to some interesting questions about whether you have two assaults when a person hits another person twice. My answer to that, which may be sophistry, is that you have to have two complete sets of elements of the crime in order to create two different offenses. And if you can only prove one continuous intent to assault, then you only have one crime. And two actus reuses, two punches, doesn't constitute two assaults unless there is, as you indicated, some time for the formulation of a separate and distinct intent to commit an assault. Now, I think that the bill could be amended to explicitly state that, and perhaps it ought to be to make it clear, because one of my main concerns is to avoid and put an end to the litigation that has gone on for a decade on this subject.
Mr. Chairman, can prosecutors, is there a problem with prosecution, can they, the pause for reflection element, is that impossible to prove in your opinion, or is it something that factual, case-by-case determination?
I hesitate to speak for the district attorneys, but I think that it is the kind of issue that could be resolved on a case-by-case basis. And an example of how that works and works quite effectively is with respect to kidnapping. Garcia cited a lot for the proposition that was mentioned earlier, that you only have one large sodomy if the person is sodomized in three distinctly different ways. But another aspect of that case, which I think is generally recognized as being a correct statement of the law, is that you determine whether there is a kidnapping by whether there is proof of a separate intent to interfere with the liberty of another individual. So you can have a rape and kidnapping and two separate convictions entered, and that's not a merger problem, that's a question of proof. And so the judge instructs the jury that in order to find to convict the defendant of kidnapping in addition to the rape, you must find a separate and distinct intent to interfere substantially with the liberty of the victim. I think that similar kinds of standards and similar kinds of instructions could flow, so that it becomes a jury question whether there has been one assault or two. In effect, that's what we do now, but then after the jury makes its determination that there have been two assaults, the judge is required by law to rewrite history and say, no, there was only one big assault, or there was only one large rape. With respect to House Bill 2268, the Department of Justice supports the bill. We supported it in the last session. In fact, it was drafted for a reason that is not really related to the problem of merger, but I can see how the two dovetail together. We introduced the bill because of an attack that was mounted about 3 years ago by the State Public Defender's Office on the decision of the Supreme Court in 1965 in State versus Jones. State versus Jones held that a sentencing court has the inherent authority to impose consecutive sentences, despite the fact that there is no express statutory authority. The public defender started filing briefs, frankly, in cases where it could find no other issue to raise, arguing that consecutive sentences were not within the inherent authority of the court because sentencing is an inherently statutory creature. And if there isn't any statutory authority, the authority doesn't exist. A judge doesn't have the inherent authority to impose a jail term unless the legislature says that a jail term is possible. We believe that there is enough evidence in these, in the criminal code now, no less than a half a dozen statutes, where the legislature assumes the authority of the trial court to impose consecutive sentences. For example, in dealing with how you deal with them in terms of the matrix, statutes provide that that when consecutive sentences are imposed, they are to be stacked, and the parole board has the authority to unstack them. Another statute says that it will be that a sentence imposed will be presumed to be concurrent unless the court indicates that it is to be consecutive. Our argument in response to the public defender is that there is the authority, the legislature has recognized that authority, but I am advised by, on a very informal basis, by certain members of the court that there is concern that the arguments advanced by the public defender are well reasoned and ought to be considered, and frankly I think the court has held its hand in not taking a case, the Supreme Court, in not taking a case to reconsider State versus Jones in anticipation that the legislature will address the problem. And I fear that if the problem is not addressed in some way in this legislative session, we will be back in the Supreme Court in the next year arguing about whether State versus Jones still is good law. I remain confident, nevertheless, that we would win, but I would feel more comfortable with a statute that expressly authorizes it. Having said all of that, I recognize that when you take House Bill 2267 and 2268, concern has been expressed from several quarters that you give the sentencing judge vast discretion to impose very lengthy sentences by stacking the matrix, and that discretion, given the way that sentence review proceeds now, would be virtually unreviewable. We're sympathetic to those concerns that have been expressed, and therefore we submit that the committee ought to use, as Mr. Sandrock suggested, House Bill 2268 as a vehicle to define in some at least broad-based way the criteria upon which a circuit judge should proceed in determining whether to make sentences arising out of the same criminal episode consecutive or concurrent. One example that we mentioned in our written testimony is that you might limit the imposition of consecutive sentences to person-to-person violent crimes as opposed to property crimes. I think that whatever criteria you develop, ultimately you ought to require the judge to make express findings relating to those criteria in order to impose consecutive sentences, in order to facilitate judicial review of the sentence that's imposed, or review by the parole board in determining whether to unstack it. And like Mr. Sandrock, the Department of Justice stands ready to assist the committee in any way we can in developing criteria and hopefully solving this seemingly eternal problem.
Thank you. Questions?
I have one, and that is, in the 49 other state jurisdictions, is there a majority-minority rule on these kinds of issues?
I think that it would be difficult to break it down into majority and minority rule, because the problem of carving out offenses is so inextricably related to the nature of the sentencing system. One of the reasons that we have a doctrine of merger that is as fully developed as we do, and I'm not aware of any other state that has such a fully developed system, is because of the oddity of an indeterminate sentencing system, the application of a matrix, where the trial judge really only has two ways of varying from the matrix. He can impose a minimum sentence, or he can impose a consecutive sentence which stacks the matrix. In an ideal world, perhaps there ought to be greater room for gradations of punishment based upon multiple offenses within the same transaction, so that instead of saying, I'm going to make the sentences consecutive and thereby double the amount of time that you spend in jail, the judge could say, you've been convicted of both rape and robbery, and so therefore I'm going to give you 5 years on the rape, and I'm going to aggravate that by another year on the robbery. It's very difficult under the current system for the judge to do that. And I don't think that looking at other states is particularly helpful.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Did you have Berkanovich?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Judy Brasanovich. I'm a staff lawyer with the Metropolitan Public Defender in Portland. I guess by way of introduction, I should say that somehow I earned the reputation as the office expert on merger. Then to try and live up to that, I had the dubious distinction of now having read every merger case that's been decided in Oregon. There are several points I want to address. The public defender is opposed to this bill. Some of the same reasons that Judge Hargraves mentioned. The language in sections 2 and 3, there's no definition of victim here. Is a victim, for example, a person who's merely present when a crime is committed and just happens to be there? And is that a victim, or is it somebody actually injured by the conduct? Clearly, that definition would have to be provided, and there might be objections to that, depending on what that would be. The first objection, it seems to me, this is, since the whole question of punishment is one of legislative intent, where changes really need to be made, if there are problem areas, is it's in the substantive statutes. You can't take a sweeping bill like this that would set these rules and attempt to apply this. There are at least 8 different situations where the question of multiple punishment would arise, and they're very dissimilar. And you can't take, simply to make an easily applied test, you can't take an area that's that complex and settle it with one kind of rule. It would require different kinds of considerations. The way to do that would be to address the substantive statutes in the areas where there are concerns or problems when those offenses are merged. And I, just by way of passing, and this is my personal opinion, there's been a lot of concern about that one portion of the Garcia decision in which 3 sodomies were merged. The sodomy that resulted was not merged with the rape, for example, and the kidnap was not merged. But there, it would seem to me to be not a difficult problem to insert in the offenses against persons section some kind of rule. In this chapter, the offenses committed against persons, you know, will be separate offenses and will not be merged. You know, not that language, but it's a simple thing to fix where there are real areas of concern, not attempt to apply something like this to at least 8 different, very dissimilar situations. It's just an area that's not functionally amenable to one mechanical rule.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that concept is not so different from what I was putting forward to Mr. Gary, that all we need to be is more explicit under our offenses so that we can distinguish clearly one offense from another. If there are multiple forms of sodomy and you want to treat them as discrete crimes, could you not just identify them under separate subsections of the sodomy statute so that you would have separate offenses?
I don't see any reason why you couldn't do that. And if you want to draw the distinction between crimes against persons and crimes against property, I think you could insert something into the chapter dealing with offenses against persons. Now, another major problem with this bill and the others that have come before it, which in many ways are identical, it leads to virtually the unbridled discretion of the prosecutor. It leaves far too much in the way of the eventual consequence of a person who commits a crime or more than one crime, all depending on how many charges that particular prosecutor or the policy of that particular prosecutor's office or that particular county, that particular part of the state, wants to carve up a criminal episode. And this would aggravate the whole problem of disparity. You know, in earlier testimony today, in terms of the disparities in sentences by judges, that would still be present, but there'd be the added element of now you have, in one county, 5 different crimes charged for the same episode, factually the same episode as perhaps in another county, or another district attorney in the same county charges only the end result crime, for example, and not every single statutory provision that was treaded across on the way to that crime. So then you have a person in a position to be sentenced in one county for the same conduct for 5 crimes, another county for 1. It would turn out, I think, that what happens to a person who has committed a crime would depend just about as much on what the district attorney does, the stroke of the district attorney's pen, as it would on what that person did. I don't think a system like ours can tolerate that kind of breadth of discretion and the disparity that would result from that. I know that there's an argument that the parole board can correct that sort of disparity, but I think not. If this bill were to pass and prosecutors around the state were free to pin as many charges as they chose, essentially, the parole board would then be in a position to have to do the same kind of ad hoc factual analysis that courts are now doing. And the parole board, in order to, so there wouldn't be this kind of disparity, and the parole board is much less equipped in terms of legal training, for example, and they're much less well equipped to have any kind of uniform, to develop uniform policies. I wanted to give an example or two just in terms of the how major the concern really is that the increased role the prosecutor would have in the eventual outcome based on the same kind of conduct in place A or place B. Interestingly enough, the Linthwaite facts are a pretty good example of that. There were four separate people, one defendant who took out a knife and pointed it at each of four people. This incident occurred in a park. The prosecutor in that case, and in fact the court saw fit to make a footnote about the zeal in this case, the prosecutor in that case charged everything he could think of. So as for that one act, as to each of the four victims, this person was charged with three separate crimes for that one act. So as to victim number one, it was menacing, pointing a knife, recklessly endangering, and attempting to use a dangerous weapon. Now, if this bill were to pass, there would be nothing to prevent convictions and sentences on all those crimes, even though it was standing here in the one act. What the court did in that case was merge the menacing, recklessly endangering into the attempted use of a dangerous weapon as to each of the four people, did not merge the four attempting to use a dangerous weapon into one. I mean, there were four distinct victims, as the court saw it. But just because more than one statute was walked across didn't necessarily have anything to do with what should be the disposition. Here's this person standing and doing one act, essentially. Another example that would be fairly interesting if this bill were to pass, if a person were to, say, attempt to get a wallet, happen to have a gun, replace the gun, this is the one victim, replace the gun, pull out a knife, and then attempt to stab, not actually do so, but attempt to eventually get the wallet and run. That's violating the robbery one statute in three separate ways, not to mention menacing and a number of other things. Could that person be convicted and sentenced for three robbery ones? I think under the language of either, depending on how this would be interpreted, given some problems with the language, either under, in section two, either under sub one or sub three, the answer would be yes. Three robbery ones. It seems clear that it would result in disparate sentencing that would not be correctable by the parole board. There are questions of proportionality. It seems that it's got to be based on an ad hoc determination of what was actually done and the background of the offender. It's the classic competing interest of the nature of the crime and the nature of the person committing the crime, and the sentencing should be accordingly. Not based on how many sections of the statute happen to be transgressed when those are directed at individual instances. I'm trying to be brief. I'm sure this committee is well aware of the practical effects on an already beleaguered court system that this would raise. Concern that it would cause more trials and fewer plea bargains if prosecutors were free to charge as many and whatever they chose within the facts, then it can be assumed that a criminal defendant in a plea offer would be expected to plead to more crimes. I think that we would find that there would be fewer pleas, more trials. That's an obvious burden on the court system, all for the same conduct. It would result in longer trials. If you have a multiplicity of charges, it's going to take longer for the evidence, longer to instruct the jury. It's another drain on the court system. I believe it would result in an increase in appeals. If there are more trials, there are bound to be more appeals. It's also possible that in weak cases, if not often, the practice for district attorneys to charge to select out more of the statutes that have been violated when they have a weak case, because then they can read off more charges when you have the jury sitting there. So it seems, well, this person must have done something, and so they might, the more charges that are there in front of them, they might choose one. So there's some reason to fear that there might be some direct use of this to gain a tactical advantage of the jury. The overall result, it would seem, of more trials, more convictions for more offenses, and longer sentences would seem sure to drastically increase the prison population. That's another great drain on the system. There are ways to deal with this. There certainly are provisions for greater sentences when it's an egregious situation, enhancement statutes, up to half of the maximum in any felony. Again, if there are specific areas of concern, you know, be it a distinction between crimes against persons or property, be it a concern about, for example, the sodomies in the Garcia case, if there are specific areas of concern, the way to approach it would seem, rather than, while you get an easily to apply test, it doesn't meet some real basic considerations in attempting to just come up with a test like this. You just go back to those substantive areas and you address them there. It would seem to me to be a simple thing to do, and you avoid the problems that are inherent in an approach like this. That's all I have.
Thank you. Questions?
Do you have any problem with the concept that Linthwaite case situation, that pulling out a knife and threatening four people should be, a person should get more time than pulling out a knife and threatening one person?
That can be done under the current law.
No, I said, did you have any problem with that concept, that they should get more time?
Do I have a problem with it?
Yes.
I don't have a problem with that concept.
Or also the Garcia triple sodomy, do you have any problem with the concept that person should get more time than the person would do like one act of sodomy?
I don't have any problem with that. I just think that there are ways to for the person to get more time now without doing it this way. There were a couple of things I wanted to address. I don't know if it's appropriate, so you can tell me if it's not, that Mr. Sandrock mentioned when he was up here. I don't think in a review of all the cases, I don't think that it's quite accurate to say that there's not a pattern right now in the case law that's discernible. And I think some of the concerns that Mr. Sandrock at least raised are currently being addressed by the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. One of those was, I think he raised the two areas of injuring several victims, and the other area, injuring the same victim more than once in the same criminal episode. And the Court of Appeals very clearly in Linthwaite and in other cases, it appears to me to be the emerging rule that intentional crimes against persons, there will be as many crimes separately punishable under the Linthwaite analysis under both categories, Linthwaite and other cases that have come since Linthwaite. So I think that is being addressed. We won't have the final answer until the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court decides that case. As I understand it, they've had it since 1981. It appears in the case law that's the pattern. The intentional crimes will be treated differently against persons. And there already is built into that a pause to reflect. That's already part of the judicial doctrine. The separate burglaries of an apartment complex, I think, is a red herring. I don't believe that would merge now. Those would be separate burglaries. The analysis of the pause to reflect would enter in there. Again, judges have the tools to deal harshly with egregious situations right now, consecutive sentences, minimums, and also aggravation. In in terms of one point Mr. Gary made, though he would probably be in a better position to know than I, in terms of the multiple litigation, it appeared to me that the number of cases dealing with merger decreased drastically after late 79, early 80. And there have really, at least in terms of, you know, Court of Appeals decisions and Supreme Court, there haven't been, it's true that from 71 through 79, there was massive litigation. After Cloutier and some of the others, it appears to me to have fallen off.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Mr. Russell?
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Russell. I am an assistant to Governor Attia. I'm here to testify basically on all three bills, 2267, 2268, and 2896. I have provided the subcommittee with written testimony, and I won't repeat that testimony. Most of what I have has been said. 2267 and 2268 were introduced by the Department of Justice at the request of the Oregon District Attorneys Association when the Special Commission Against Violent Crime reviewed these issues. They recommended to the governor that he introduce legislation on these matters. When we found that legislation had already been introduced in these particular House bills, instead of going the way of introduction, we elected to support and endorse these bills, and that's basically why I'm here. The question with 2267 of how subsections 2 and subsections 3 should read are difficult questions to answer. There's another area I know, since the subcommittee is going to be looking at it, there's another area that cropped up that I have not heard mentioned this afternoon, and that was a case that cropped up in the early 70s called State versus Raggiani, which there were, I'm not sure whether it was multiple offenses or not. It was the same statute, but it was a possession of three different controlled substances at the same time. The court avoided the entire problem because Mr. Raggiani had entered three different guilty pleas with knowledge that he could in fact be sentenced, and he got three different maximum consecutive sentences. So it is an area repeated, has been suggested that it be through time. I'm not quite sure that would apply to possession.
Sounds like again, some sort of malpractice at a minimum.
Again, it is as long as it is something that's going to be looked at, I would raise the possession type of thing as an additional item to consider. 2268 is basically, as has been described, a clarification of present statutes, and I really have nothing more to add to what has been said. 2896 is a bill that has been introduced through this House Judiciary Committee at the request of Governor Attia and the Special Commission Against Violent Crime. It would provide an additional tool to judges in the sentencing process. The report of the Special Commission has been attached to the testimony, and I only have one item that I would add to it because they did not specifically mention it. And that is, although the Special Commission mentioned that probation might be more effective in a given case because, in effect, you could send a person down here, let him get a taste of what it's like down here in Salem on a relatively short sentence, and now that you've got that person's attention, bring him back, and he probably will be more inclined not to violate the terms of that probation now that he's seen what it's like. An aspect that the Special Commission didn't deal with is it's likely on those short sentence situations that that individual may not be turned loose into the Salem Marion-Polk County area, but may be brought back to that hometown. His problems, if he's going to continue to have them, are not going to be resolved probably by taking out of his home, taking him out of, or her out of the home community.
Is that mentioned in your written testimony?
This is mentioned in the written testimony. It is a matter that I have heard raised in this committee before on other bills relating to an inordinate number of people being sprung loose or popped loose into the Salem area.
I'm sure if you sent that in the personal letter to Representative Courtney, would lock up his vote right now.
The
probably Representative Hill, too.
Yeah, I was going to say with two, I think.
May I ask a question as long as I rudely interrupt? Do we have a fiscal impact, or is there an anticipated fiscal impact of 2896 extended periods of probation this way? And does the probation fall on the, I guess, the state probationary system? Because as I understood earlier testimony, Jim, this would have the effect of lengthening periods of probation by which heretofore have been knocked out by virtue of serving time in the penitentiary, at which time they come back and they're no longer able to put them on probation. They might do 6 months parole. But it would seem to be enhancing the caseloads this way.
Mr. Chairperson,